There's this scene in the 2004 film Team America World Police, where UN weapons inspector Hans Blix confronts Kim Jong-il about inspecting his nuclear program. Blix demands access to inspect Kim's palace, or else, quote, "We will be very, very angry with you, and we will write you a letter telling you how angry we are." Now that's about as sophomoric a movie reference as you're going to hear me make on this podcast, but I think it does a pretty good job of illustrating the popular notion, at least here in the US, of how the United Nations operates. As the UN approaches its 70th anniversary this month, few would question its value as a forum for discourse on global issues. But the fact that the UN is limited in its ability to dictate what member states do makes it hard to understand how it can accomplish anything. Today we're going to get a glimpse of just one of the ways the UN manages to lead without the need of force. In this case, in the field of human rights. Hello and welcome to the Harvard Kennedy School PolicyCast. I'm your host, Matt Cadwallader, and you can subscribe to us on iTunes or elsewhere by visiting hkspolicycast.org. You can also find us every week in Boston Globe Opinion and on Twitter at PolicyCast. Today we're joined by HKS Professor John Ruggie, who's twice served in senior roles at the UN, including a stint as Assistant Secretary General for Strategic Planning under Kofi Annan, and later as the Secretary General's Special Representative for Business and Human Rights. Professor Ruggie, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm glad to be with you.
You know, when I think of human rights organizations, NGOs spring to mind.
Right.
But your work is focused on specifically on for-profit organizations, corporations, and how they can impact human rights around the world.
Right.
Can you explain how you got into this particular line of work in the first place?
Well, the NGOs, the advocacy groups, are and always have been the driving force putting these issues on the global agenda. Amnesty, for example, one of the oldest of these organizations, focused initially on prisoners of conscience and trying to get them released from prison by pressuring states through various ways. Mm-hmm. And so historically, this has been a dynamic that's taken place between NGOs and states. Starting in the 1990s, with the explosion of globalization, people discovered that corporations, especially large multinational corporations, have an enormous effect on the enjoyment of human rights. They can be either part of the problem or they can be part of the solution, and therefore attention has increased on multinationals. The challenge has been that there have been no standards. The international human rights protection standards, if we can call them that, all were based on the idea that states, one, were the violators of human rights, state agencies, but they also needed to be the protectors of human rights. It never included the private sector in the equation. And that's what changed largely as a result of globalization.
So when you talk about human rights, what does that include?
It includes workplace standards. Rana Plaza, 1,200 people died when the building collapsed in which T-shirts and other clothing apparel was being manufactured for European and American retailers.
This was in Bangladesh?
In Bangladesh, mm-hmm. Yeah. So it includes workers' rights, beginning with basic safety issues and moving up to freedom of association, collective bargaining, regulation of overtime, and that sort of thing. And then you have a bundle of rights that go along with various communities. So if you look at the extractive industry, whether it's mining oil or gas, they have enormously big physical footprints. And often when you start a new mine, for example, communities have to be moved. How do they get moved? Is there adequate consultation? Is there adequate compensation? Mm-hmm. Or do the bulldozers show up one morning and just, you know, push the houses or the huts yeah. into the ground and let people fend for themselves? Mm-hmm. Internet issues having to do with internet providers the privacy concerns, the right to privacy. So there's a whole array of issues affecting virtually every kind of industry. I did a survey when I began my mandate as special representative of the Secretary General is there any human right that is not affected by business? And you can't come up with many. Somebody mentioned, judicial issues are not in the hands of business. My response was, yes, but judges can be bribed. So we essentially said it would be foolish to try to single out any particular kind of human right or type of human right. Mm-hmm. It's across the board.
So you were a driving force in the development and adoption of the UN's guiding principles on business and human rights, mm-hmm. which were implemented in 2011. Why did the UN feel it necessary to invest resources into putting together this list of these standards?
Well, I think there was a recognition that the time was ripe to do this. Advocacy groups would put pressure on companies. Each advocacy group had their own idea of what the company should be doing with regard to human rights. Mm-hmm. The companies would respond by saying, well, we can't respond to all of these requests because they're all over the place, they're inconsistent, they're contradictory, some are complementary. And the UN itself came to realize that its focus on states was insufficient. Because of the role of the private sector, not only in the area of human rights, but in everything, poverty reduction. You can't do poverty reduction without involving the private sector. Mm-hmm. So there was a general feeling that the time was ripe to try to build enough consensus so that you could work toward a set of common standards that would be applicable to the responsibilities of states and companies alike with regard to the protection and respect for human rights.
So can you explain how the guidelines work?
Well, the guiding principles they rest on what we ended up describing as pillars, three pillars. One is the duty of states, the international legal obligations that states undertake when they ratify human rights treaties. Among those obligations is they have a duty to protect against human rights abuses, not only by state agents, but by third parties, which includes business. So mm-hmm. that's the first element. The second element is the responsibility of companies to respect human rights, which means to not infringe on the rights of others as they go about their business. And that requires that they have systems in place to know and show that they respect human rights. And that's where the human rights due diligence element comes in. Mm-hmm. And the third pillar is access to remedy, which includes a judicial remedy, but also non-judicial remedy, alternative dispute resolution techniques, which can be both public sector, but they can also be private sector. There are more and more companies are adopting grievance mechanisms right at the local level to sort of head off to deal with small grievances or relatively small grievances before they escalate into major confrontations.
These guidelines were accepted in 2011. Mm-hmm. Has there been enough time to actually do an analysis and find out whether they've been effective?
Yeah, there is a London-based nonprofit called the Business and Human Rights Resource Center that sort of tracks the business and human rights situation. And the best information that we have from them is that certainly leading companies have picked up on this in a significant way. There's many elements to the guiding principles. But the preventative side of it, that is to say, the core element of the guiding principles for companies is to adopt to conduct appropriate human rights due diligence, that is to say, to actually assess what the potential, what the actual and potential impacts, adverse impacts, will be of whatever activity that they are planning to engage in, and then to process that information in their plans, and to provide avenues for redress, so that people can actually not only be consulted but also lodge complaints about what the company may be doing.
Now, the idea of corporate social responsibility is relatively new. Mm-hmm. You, as in your role at the UN, were meeting with corporations and other stakeholders in trying to develop these standards. Did you find that over time they became more receptive to this idea that they had some responsibility to fulfill?
Yeah, I mean, you can't generalize across all businesses. There's 80,000 multinational corporations in the world, and they have about 800,000 subsidiaries. And so it's, you know...
You didn't meet with all of them?
I didn't meet with all... No, I spent 6 years doing that, but I did not meet all 800,000. It was clear that a community of practice was being built up, especially among the leading companies. That is to say that they increasingly realized that they needed to onboard the capacity to deal with these with some of the social and environmental consequences of their actions, if only to reduce reputational risk or the risk of being sued by somebody, and that sort of thing.
It's hard to imagine a for-profit institution pursuing something that is not to make a profit. Was this drive towards responsibility principally to avoid lawsuits?
In some cases, companies began to see competitive advantages. I remember one CEO visiting us in the Secretary General's office. And he happened to be the CEO of one of the world's biggest oil companies. And he said, look, we are basically an engineering business. Everybody can pay the same salary. What's our competitive advantage vis-a-vis other people, other companies? We want to retain the best possible engineers. We want to make them feel good about where they work. We want them to feel committed to the company. Mm-hmm. And one way to make them feel committed is to ensure that the company does everything possible to do the right thing. Mm-hmm. So there's a variety of motivations. Also, the time element plays into this. There are some CEOs, and it depends in part on the industry as well, who have a fairly longer time horizon than others. You know, a mining company is going to be in a community for 30 years. If they get off on the wrong foot, it's very hard to correct. If you're sort of a hit-and-run business, it's a different story. You don't care as much.
Right. The 70th anniversary of the UN's founding is quickly approaching. These seem to be kind of concrete examples of how the UN can actually make a difference.
Right, right.
Do you think that this is one of the more effective ways for the UN to exert some force for good in the world?
Absolutely. I think the two major contributions, the two major sort of indispensable contributions of the UN is, one, its convening power. It can bring people together and countries together to address issues for which the opportunity wouldn't otherwise exist. And secondly, it has a normative role. That is to say, when, for example, the idea of corporate social responsibility began to emerge, countries like China or India Brazil were highly resistant to sort of private sector ideas for what corporate social responsibility would mean.
What do you mean by private sector ideas?
When business associations would come up with their own set of standards. Mm-hmm. And, you know, China would say, who are you? You know, you're the chemical industry. Why should we be paying attention to you?
Right.
But when the UN based recommendations on sort of universally accepted principles that governments themselves had endorsed, China was fine with that, you know, and India was fine with that, and Brazil was fine with that. So the convening power and the normative power of the UN are absolutely indispensable roles. And the third one is coming in after some disaster and picking up the pieces. Mm-hmm. There isn't anybody else who can, NGOs are deeply involved in humanitarian operations, but there isn't anybody who can sort of coordinate the whole thing into a package, mm-hmm. and get access to states and mobilize resources the way the UN can.
You've also recently been speaking about large multinational organizations like FIFA, mm-hmm. And the Olympics, mm-hmm. And the role that they play in human rights. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean it shows you how far this basic idea of human rights has traveled. That the one of the current frontiers is what we call mega sporting events, which includes the World Cup. It includes the Olympics. Now the host country bidders may or may not have adequate protections in place for workers. It's clear that Qatar doesn't, mm-hmm. and so on and so forth. And so we've been increasingly reaching out to these mega sporting bodies to include in their contracts with the bidders and with the host countries and host cities and the companies that construct stadiums and all the rest of it, that in the contractual obligations there should be included these provisions for adequate consideration of the rights of the workers and the rights of the communities that are impacted.
I should note for our listeners, if they aren't familiar with Qatar, is hosting, what is it, the 2018
2022
World Cup, and have been considerable questions about the human rights of the people who are building the stadiums.
Right, they're largely from South Asia. They're imported. Labor brokers bring them in. Safety conditions clearly were inadequate. Hundreds and hundreds of people, workers, have died. Mm-hmm. And that sort of thing should be unacceptable to an organization like FIFA that right. organizes a World Cup and should be included in the contractual obligations that that the host country undertakes.
Now, obviously, FIFA has seen some pretty bad headlines recently itself.
Right,
you might think that they would be eager to pursue something that would bring them some positive publicity for once. Have they been receptive? Has FIFA, the Olympics, all these different mega sporting events?
It's very much on their agenda, including the International Olympic Committee, the Commonwealth Games, Formula One racing, and FIFA itself. Mm-hmm. Very much on their agenda.
How does an organization like that pursue? Is it just mean that they adopt the UN guidelines?
Well, the FIFA, in 2014, Mary Robinson is the patron of a nonprofit in London called the Institute for Human Rights and Business, and I chair their international advisory committee. We sent a joint letter to the head of FIFA saying essentially, look, here are some of the adverse human rights impacts of World Cup games. Mm-hmm. And we suggest that you follow certain procedures and adopt certain principles or requirements. And FIFA, in fact, began a process of revising their bidding requirements and has asked for help in constructing a much more robust system that would respect that would build in respect for human rights into its contracts.
I have one last question, and it's kind of zooming out a little bit, we've been talking about, you know, specific guidelines in the United Nations. You watch the news and human rights, it's constantly under threat in areas all around the world. It might be a little bit hard to get some perspective on the direction that we're moving. Obviously, people are paying more attention to corporate social responsibility. People are paying more attention to human rights in general. Mm-hmm. Are things getting better?
In relative terms, yes. Are we where we should be? No. I think that's the short answer, that we're in a place today. We couldn't even have had conversations about this subject 10 years ago because people wouldn't have known what you were talking about.
Sure.
And today there are large communities of practice in the private sector whose job it is to manage these issues. So in that sense, we're certainly making progress. Are we where we should be? No, there's lots more work to be done. Mm-hmm. So I've sort of described where we are, not at the end, but not even at the beginning of the end, but at the end of the beginning.
Well, Harvard Kennedy School Professor John Ruggie, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
If you'd like to learn more about the UN Guiding Principles on Business and Human Rights, you can find a link in the show notes. HKS PolicyCast is produced by Matt Cadwallader and Molly Lanzarota, photography by Tatiana Johnson. Special thanks to those who help get us out there every week, including Catherine Serafin at Harvard, as well as Ellen Clegg and Nicole Hernandez at the Boston Globe. And to you for listening in. See you next week.
You've been listening to the Harvard Kennedy School PolicyCast. You can subscribe to PolicyCast on iTunes, Stitcher, and elsewhere by visiting hkspolicycast.org. And let us know what you think on Twitter